The next case is 09609, Ohio Attorney General versus American Booksellers Foundation for Free Expression. Mr. Meiser.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. For decades, Ohio law has protected minors by prohibiting adults from directly disseminating obscene materials to them. More recently, the General Assembly amended that law for the internet age, and revised code 2907.31 now bars adults from sending directly to minors electronic communications that contain material defined as harmful to juveniles. Three key limitations in the statutory text, directness, knowledge, and control, confirm the Attorney General's interpretation of the law and provide ready affirmative answers to the Sixth Circuit's questions. First, directness, because the statute covers only direct communications to a juvenile. Second, knowledge, because the statute covers only speakers who know or have reason to know that a particular recipient is a juvenile. And third, control, because the statute excludes broadcast communications such as websites and listservs where the speaker cannot exclude or limit the recipient list. Given these three textual limitations and the deference that is owed to the interpretation of the Attorney General and the prosecutors as enforcers of the law, this court should answer yes to the Sixth Circuit's questions. The statutory text is clear, but in order to aid the reading of that statutory text, I think it's helpful to look at the purpose of the law and the way the law would be enforced, which was demonstrated at trial. This law is about targeting sexual predators. This is not a law like earlier laws that have been invalidated by the U.S. Supreme Court with respect to wholesale regulation of the internet that covers websites on the World Wide Web. This is a law about person-to-person communications because those are the types of communications that are often used by sexual predators to prey on children and youth. Those types of communications are used to groom a child for later solicitation of sex. And those communications often occur these days over the internet by email or instant message.
Counsel, would a communication from a an individual that is general in nature, but directed to a site that is would mostly be looked at by kids, would that bring one a possible jeopardy? For example, I assume Miley Cyrus, who is very popular with kids, probably has a website. If someone directs a communication in there, are they at risk at that point, or does something more have to happen?
Assuming the website you're positing, Your Honor, is something like a chat room where you can post communications on the website.
I'm not that up to speed with all of the terminology, so you're going to have to help me through this. But where one directs this, you've suggested that general dissemination does not lead one at risk for criminal prosecution, but if the general dissemination is not quite so general, it's going to an area where one has hope that the folks, the kids that they're interested in grooming, would be paying attention. Are you at risk for criminal jeopardy at that point, or does something more have to happen?
You're not at risk of being covered by the statute, Your Honor, because the 2907.31D2, which explains that if the communication is open to all comers, and if you can't exclude certain recipients, then it's a communication that's not covered by the statute. And You know, perhaps we as a society wish we could reach communications like that, but this statute is more carefully tailored to target the one-to-one communications that sexual predators use to prey on a particular youth.
So if one directed a communication to a site where they expected the phishing would be good, they're not at risk until communications come back and then there's a follow-up to that. Is that?
That's right, and this goes to the demonstration that was actually made to the federal district court, where an officer from the Xenia Police Department Internet Child Protection Unit testified and actually demonstrated on computer that live for the district court judge that he could enter a chat room, and the chat room was open to all comers. And so that's not the kind of communication that would be covered by this statute. But then once a predator actually started communicating with him because he was posing as a minor, then the predator asked him to go into a private communication, sort of like an instant message, where only those two people were part of the communication.
Is that the limitation of this 31?
It's a natural reading of 31, which says that the communication is only covered if the sender or the speaker can exclude particular recipients, and that's D2B, and also if the sender knows or has reason to know that the particular recipient is a juvenile. And so if anyone can see your communication, or if a large number of people can see your communications and you don't know that one of them is a minor and you can't exclude them, then it's not covered. Only when you're in that smaller one-to-one communication. And so this is a very carefully tailored statute to
your reading of 31 then is a limited communication with an individual who is known to be a juvenile.
Or a small group of group of individuals where you can exclude recipients if you choose. So for example, listservs are a type of communication where you send an email to an address and it gets to one address and it gets bounced to lots of subscribers. You can't, in sending a message to a listserv, exclude particular recipients. And therefore, under D2B, a listserv wouldn't be covered because you don't have the control. So control and knowledge, in addition to directness, are key to the application of this statute. And that is why the Sixth Circuit was correct to ask whether the statute only applies to person-to-person communications and, in fact, excludes websites that are open to all comers.
How does an individual learn or get information or adequate information that the one being communicated with is a juvenile?
Well, it may be that there would be some communications where that there is not adequate information for that knowledge, and therefore, even though perhaps something untoward is happening, the statute couldn't reach that. This is about emails and instant messages or other forms of communication where you know that the sexual predator knows what he is doing.
How do we get around the void for vagueness because we're unsure of the individual with whom we're communicating is a juvenile?
Two responses, Your Honor. First, with respect to vagueness, and then second, with respect to the meaning of the statute. The vagueness issues are not before this court. That's the constitutional challenge that the Sixth Circuit has asked this court to answer questions to help it answer. But even with respect to vagueness, the statute is not vague just because there may be some applications that might be in question. The Supreme Court of the United States has explained that what vagueness means is when you can't even tell what the contours of the statute's application are. Here we know what the contours are because we know that the qualities that are covered are knowledge, control, and directness. And so we know that if an individual doesn't know or have reason to know that a particular individual with whom he's communicating obscenely or with harmful materials is a juvenile, then he's not covered. And knowledge is not a vague standard. That knowledge is a fundament of criminal law.
Mr. Miser, this group of juveniles that is in the statute, I understand the one-on-one when you're talking about directness and control, but when you're talking about groups of juveniles, for example, your listserv, if you had a listserv that was directed solely to teenagers, are you saying that the statute would not cover that particular situation, although that would be a group of juveniles?
I think it would depend on the facts in the particular case. If, say, there was a listserv for a Little League team, and the coach or someone else sends an email to that list, I think that all three elements, directness, knowledge, and control, would probably all be present in that case, and so that it might be covered. But if there's a larger range of individuals and there's not as much knowledge, not sufficient knowledge on behalf of the speaker, then it wouldn't be covered.
It's, my problem is that it seems your explanation of the statute is not quite the way the statute is written. I mean, I understand that you're attempting to narrow it, but the way it's written now, we don't really have it set forth in the language that you've described it.
Respectfully, I think that we do, because it's necessary to read not just D1, but also D2. So D1 does talk about an individual or a group of persons. But then D2 is the one that places a further limitation by requiring that the speaker have adequate knowledge to know that a particular recipient is a juvenile and the ability to control and exclude juveniles if he chooses. And on a listserv, if there's a listserv, for example, where there are multiple recipients, both adults and juveniles, and the speaker can't control who receives it, then that would likely not be covered because of the exception under 31D2B.
Assuming that we uphold the statute, this will be a very difficult opinion to write, it seems to me. As you know, the respondents have suggested that there's such vagueness here that we shouldn't even attempt to make the statute constitutional, I guess is the way to put it. You responded to that, but I'd like to hear your strongest argument on that. It seems to me the Sixth Circuit is at least implied in their certified question, which I found in the Appellee's brief first. It seems to me they kicked this to us because they couldn't decide either. What's your response?
I think that I don't think it's too vague to answer, and I don't think the questions are too vague to answer either, because of the statutory textual limitations that require direct communications. The word direct appears numerous times in the statute. Also because of the knowledge requirement that the speaker know that a particular recipient be a juvenile. And third, the requirement of control and the ability to exclude particular recipients. So given these textual limitations, I think that the Sixth Circuit's questions are actually quite easy to answer, because those questions are focused first on whether or not the covered communication is a person-to-person communication, such as instant messages or email, and then second, whether or not it excludes websites. And I think both of those questions are answered by the statutory text.
It will be difficult, will not, for us to anticipate by the questions you received in the first 10 minutes or 15, 12 minutes of argument. There are a lot of factual issues that we can't, that would be difficult to anticipate, it seems to me, with the development of technology. How do we anticipate those in an opinion to try to gather all of those circumstances?
I don't think the court needs to anticipate them, because the court can simply confirm the categories of communication that are covered by the statute's terms. And the three limitations that I mentioned, directness, knowledge, and control. We actually think the court should decline the plaintiff's invitation to enumerate specifically which types of communications are covered, because that would hamstring the statute. We used the example in our reply brief that a legislature wouldn't try to legislate with respect to breakfast cereals, for example, by saying Frosted Flakes, Wheaties, and Cheerios are covered and everything else is not. Instead, this is the way legislatures operate. They define the categories of what they wish to legislate, and here the categories are defined. We know that there are going to be new forms of electronic communication, but if those new forms of electronic communication allow the speaker to speak directly to a particular recipient and to exclude other recipients, then the General Assembly can regulate that. And I would also tie this statute to the historical provisions that have long existed and long been upheld under the Constitution. Since the early 1970s, the Ohio law has prohibited direct communications containing obscene materials to a juvenile by U.S. Postal Service, by the mails, and the U.S. Supreme Court in Riddell said that that's fine. This is really just the same thing. It's direct communications via the internet instead of via the Postal Service. I wouldn't let the fact that this is over the internet become a red herring that distorts the fact that these are still direct communications, just like a letter in the mail.
Counsel, is text messaging considered internet?
It's considered an electronic communication.
You don't mean over the internet. You mean to include text messaging as well.
That's correct. But I think that in some of the arguments that have been made, both in the Sixth Circuit and in the papers in this court, the internet has sort of become the distorting red herring. But text messages are direct communications that would be covered.
We couldn't just say, internet. We'd have to, electronic communications would be a more appropriate.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes, my time is nearly expired.
Thank you, Mr. Meiser. Mr. Zuckerman.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This statute has plain terms, but it just means that as this case has gone through the federal courts, from the district court to the Sixth Circuit, and then has been referred to this court, everybody has had to struggle with the meaning of it. So it's had plain terms, but nobody can figure out what it means. And that is best demonstrated, I suggest, Your Honors, by looking at the positions that the state has taken in defense of the statute. And at each stage in the proceedings, the state has taken varying positions, critically different positions on how this statute would be applied in the real world by prosecutors, and how adults acting in good faith could find themselves in violation of a statute because of the vagueness of the statute. The varying positions of the state, I don't suggest for a minute, come from any strategic position or some trying to get some advantage by a change in a position. It's just a struggle to find out what this means.
Counsel, let me stop you with adults acting in good faith. That sort of stretches the term, doesn't it, good faith?
No, Your Honor. The if one looks at the scope of this statute, this
we're talking about disseminating obscene materials, are we not?
No, we're talking about disseminating material which is perfectly lawful and protected by the First Amendments in adult-to-adult communication.
All right.
But can properly be restricted, and we have no quarrel with the restriction, as harmful to juveniles if given in a communication to a juvenile. And the question is, how does one apply a harmful juvenile statute to electronic communications that does not bring into its scope improperly adult-to-adult communications that are permissible?
And the state is arguing, and I suppose part of the problem with a changing position is the technology has changed since the enactment of the statute, so everybody's dealing with changing circumstances as we speak. But could you address, the Attorney General is saying, you're excluded, you're protected, you don't come within the reaches of the statute unless you knowingly direct it to specific a uniquely juvenile audience, or if you broadcast it out more generally and underage people see this and respond, and then you respond to that. That's the first time that you're within the clutches of criminal jeopardy.
Your Honor, let me respond by applying Your Honor's question to the specific types of communication that were the parties struggled with in the district court and the court of appeals and in the briefing before this court. And these are all types of communication that were in existence in 2002 when the statute was originally enacted and in 2004 when the statute was amended. We're not talking about things that have just been developed in more recent years or more recent months or weeks. Listservs. In the argument before this court, I thought I heard Solicitor General Meiser state that listservs were not covered by the statute. But then later on, in response to a question from a different justice, I thought that Solicitor General Meiser said that if there was a listserv that was designed for a specific group of juveniles, such as
ball team.
A Girl Scout group or a Boy Scout group or some other club, that would be covered by the statute.
But that implies that you have direct communication, and that implies that you know. I mean, you're looking at things in the abstract and saying, okay, because in the abstract it could apply to other groups, it's unconstitutional or it's void, when you have to add B and C, and when you have all three, now you have a fairly narrowly defined class. And if you know your listserv is juveniles and you only send to that listserv and you know it and you know they're juveniles, why isn't that within the purview of the statute?
If the sender knows the identity of the specific persons on the listserv, that is very different from an ordinary use of a listserv. Let's start with the proposition of a one-on-one communication. We have never quarreled with the position that if there's a one-on-one email or a one-on-one instant message where an adult transmits to a person known to be
I think we understand that you would agree with that. But why is a listserv that is designed to be only juveniles, why is that too broad? Why is that vague?
Because the person who's sending it has no control over who is on the listserv, and the...
But they have knowledge. They have knowledge that's juveniles. Now, if somebody takes that listserv and sends it to a third party, yes, you're off the hook because you don't know who the third party is. But if you have knowledge that that listserv goes to juveniles, why are you protected? Why is that a void?
If a listserv is set up for the exclusive purpose of communicating with juveniles and is described as being such, and that is known to the sender, that's something that could probably come within the text of the statute.
I think that's all they were saying. It was a juvenile listserv covered, but if it's a listserv that says juveniles, parents, boosters, not covered.
And that also raises, Your Honor, an issue as to the knowledge of the recipient. And I do point out a difference between the Solicitor General's description of the knowledge element and what the statute says. The Solicitor General described it as knowing or having reason to know. The statute is far weaker than that. The statute says knows or has reason to believe that the recipient is a juvenile. And that creates a vagueness in the statute as well.
Counsel, isn't part of the problem is the to save this statute, the Attorney General, understandably, is advocating a fairly narrowly tailored interpretation of it. If we respond, can we save the statute by responding with its narrowly tailored explanation of what's in and what's out? And as the Chief suggested, that could get pretty complicated, but can we do that? And then would your potential clients be protected in perpetuity once we do that?
There are two aspects with respect to the constitutionality of the statute. One is the aspect that relates to the First Amendment issues, and there are also an aspect that relates to the Commerce Clause issues. The Commerce Clause issue is not before this court, but may be addressed by the Sixth Circuit after the questions are answered. The statute can be saved through a constitutional limitation with respect to the First Amendment issue, which would also go a long way towards correcting or addressing Commerce Clause issues with respect to the statute. And I would suggest, but answering the Sixth Circuit questions yes, and just saying yes and nothing more, we suggest would not save the statute.
Well, we generally don't do that, and wouldn't it be reasonable of us to assume that the General Assembly was trying to protect juveniles and wanted to do it in a constitutionally acceptable fashion? Does it become our job then to try and thread that needle?
Well, it's not it's not this court's job to do. It's this court's, this court has the opportunity to do that. This court can either say the statute is vague and it's up to the General Assembly to draft a constitutional law, or this court has the authority to say the statute is vague, but we are going to save it from the, we are going to seek to save it from its constitutional infirmity by construing it in this narrow way. And what we would suggest is the construction of the statute, as we've stated in our brief, is one, all websites should be excluded. The Sixth Circuit used the phrase generally accessible websites, and I'm not sure whether generally accessible was meant simply to be descriptive of what websites are, or was meant to be restrictive and meant to say that some websites are subject to the statute and some aren't. We believe, Your Honors, that to save the statute from this aspect of its unconstitutionality, all websites should be excluded from the reach of the statute.
Counsel, all websites don't operate the same way, do they? And all chat rooms don't operate the same way, and all internet email communications don't operate the same way. I wonder, it's not really the statute that's confusing here. It's the technologies are not standard components. They differ depending on how they're set up and how they're used by individuals. But isn't that a factual issue then, to see whether how it's used in a particular case fits into the overall principles and prohibitions in the statute? So aren't we really talking about vague technologies as opposed, which can be fleshed out by the factual basis, as opposed to a vague statute?
The technologies are indeed, I don't know whether I would say vague, Your Honor, but the technologies have so many different factors to it that they're very hard to classify. And it's very hard to draft a description that hits the particular technology correctly. And the task before the legislature is not an easy one because of that. But this statute, as written, leaves too many questions unanswered. And we're talking about a criminal statute which results in substantial terms of imprisonment if someone finds themselves on the wrong side of the statute.
But those answers can be discovered in the factual basis, isn't it? And how it's used in a particular situation. I mean, the same statute is going to apply or not apply depending on whether how a particular communication is done factually fits into the statutory definitions, does it not?
But the problem with the statutory definitions is that they don't give sufficient guidance to apply to particular technologies and figure out what they mean. So, for example, Your Honor, whether a technology gives a sender the ability to exclude particular recipients. Well, in a public chat room, if there is the right to establish a private chat room, then every participant in a public chat room has the ability to exclude participants by not making a communication in the public chat room and instead establishing a private chat room. But the state has always acknowledged that public chat rooms aren't subject to restriction. So you may have a private chat room that is formed for the specific purpose of trying to bring about adult communications and have a communication outside of a public chat room. So the
you're talking about an appropriate adult communications, right?
An appropriate adult-to-adult communication that might find itself on the wrong side of the statute.
You're talking about adult-to-adult communications in a subsection or a chat room that is created from a public chat room.
That's correct. Because of an error in the formation of the private chat room, minors are included.
Does he know that? Does the sender know that? That's still part of the test that you seem to ignore. He has to know that a juvenile is in there and then directly communicate with the juvenile, because if you get into a private chat room and it still has a broad base or it still has more than juveniles, you're out of the statute again.
One then gets into the area, the fuzzy area of the definition of knows or has reason to believe.
That's a factual determination by the trial court. You set up an adult chat room, a juvenile ends up in it, and you didn't know it. That doesn't meet the definition for criminal liability under the statute, does it? Don't you have to have knowledge as part of the test?
You don't have to have knowledge. You have to have knowledge or reason to believe.
How are you going to show reason to believe if the child's inappropriately in an adult chat room? It seems to me your proposed answer to question number one takes you up to, so far, everything you've said is permissible. You're in a public chat room, you go to a private chat room, you think you're doing adult-to-adult conversation or communication, you're still okay, no matter what you're sending back and forth adult material. Erroneously, there's a child that has access to it. You establish then a relationship via text, another chat, or whatever method, but it qualifies as email person to person. At that point, you would agree that there's a problem for the adult in that situation, that he's crossed the line and is now criminally involved in activity.
That's correct. If there is a one-to-one communication between an adult and a juvenile known to be a juvenile by the adult.
And I don't necessarily see anything that Mr. Miser presented to us that would not agree with what I just said.
The difficulty we have, Your Honor, with the position taken by the state, and I think the position taken by Solicitor General Miser at this court was somewhat narrower than the position that was taken in the federal courts, is that the line is drawn too far towards
the general population as opposed to the specific?
That is correct, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
And I guess I didn't necessarily hear that, but we'll explore that with them.
Do you agree, Mr. Zuckerman, that the issue of the vagueness of the statute is not before us in this hearing?
That's incorrect, Your Honor. The issue of vagueness is before the court, this court. The issue of constitutionality is not. That's a peculiar separation, but the reason that arises this way is the federal court basically says to this court, what does this statute mean? Does this statute cover instant messages and emails or not? And if the answer to that this question is yes or no, the court can answer the question without reaching a vagueness issue.
Which goes back to what the Chief Justice said in the beginning. This is a difficult case for us to try to articulate. But if we adopt the suggestion of the solicitor that we relate it to directness, knowledge, and control in a limited fashion, as you concurred with Justice O'Connor, what would be wrong with that interpretation of this statute? Eliminating the vagueness requirement that you say is before us and letting the federal courts deal with it in that fashion.
That would clearly be a step in the right direction, Your Honor. On the three issues of directness, knowledge, and control, I realize my time is up, but let me just briefly address those. Directness, it must be clear that what is meant by direct is aimed to a particular individual, not simply direct as being the opposite of indirect, which is a transmission that was retransmitted. So directness must be aimed to a particular individual. Knowledge, the knowledge requirement would have to be read not in a watered-down way. We suggest that knows is the correct standard, and reason to believe is too weak a standard, and knows or believes would be a sufficient standard. Reason to believe gets into a vague area where whether, for example, an adult should have reason to believe that a recipient was a juvenile.
Those become factual questions, as Justice Kupp had articulated earlier.
Well, they're ultimately factual questions. But the problem is that if a prosecutor could establish reason to believe based upon the language that was used by a juvenile or based upon the subject matter of discussion with a juvenile, that's just far too weak to sustain a criminal statute. And that's why knowledge or belief would be the appropriate. And on control, the issue of control must be dealt with in a strong enough way so that one doesn't leave the statute vague or worse, Your Honors, produce a counterproductive statute where, for example, someone puts information on a restricted website rather than a generally accessible website and finds themselves subject to more strict penalties because of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zuckerman. Mr. Meiser, you've saved 30 seconds.
Mr. Meiser, I have one question. The proposition of law currently says knowing or reckless transfer. Now, you didn't talk about recklessness, and I'm assuming that has been abandoned by you?
No, I would point the court to 2907.31a, which is the provision that doesn't just apply to electronic communications, but also to direct communications by the mail. Recklessness is the scienter requirement for those other forms of communication. But four canons of statutory construction, or four sets of statutory construction tools, allow this court to answer the Sixth Circuit's questions and confirm the Attorney General's reading.
Counsel, before you get to that, would you respond to the question that I asked opposing counsel? I set the scenario of an adult being in the general chat room, thinking they're in an adult-to-adult chat room, communicating, and then there's a private chat room that is an offshoot of that, still thinking there's an adult situation, and then becomes a person-to-person communication as a result to that. At what point in that sequence would you say that there's a violation that occurs?
There would be a violation only if the speaker is the one who's controlling the private conversation. So if the speaker set up the private chat room and controls who's participating, and then in addition to the control requirement then being satisfied, the knowledge requirement would have to be satisfied. So the speaker would have to know or have reason to believe or know that an individual in that private communication is a juvenile, a particular recipient of the message is a juvenile. And so, and I think that the hypothetical you were posing wouldn't be covered, if I understood the factual circumstances correctly. There's also affirmative defenses that cover the good faith of the speaker. So actually there are three different provisions, revised code 2907.31b and c, as well as 0.35, all of which cover speakers who are acting in good faith and who try not to talk to juveniles.
So pinpoint where you differ from opposing counsel in the scenario or the answer to the first certified question.
I think that at the end of their brief, we find substantial agreement in that direct communications are covered, broadcast communications are not. I think that the disagreement seems to be on plaintiff's insistence that hypotheticals suffice to invalidate the statute, and under the canon of facial challenges, they do not. The Sixth Circuit has before it a facial challenge, not an as-applied challenge, and hypotheticals don't suffice to sustain a facial challenge.
Well, Counsel, he sets out, he sets out the certified questions, which is helpful, and secondly, he sets out, Mr. Zuckerman sets out, his first choice was, we say it's too vague to even wade into this pool, but secondly, he proposes answers to both questions, and if I'm understanding you correctly, you don't like his first proposal, that is, it's gone because it's too vague, but you're in substantial agreement, at least with respect to his proposed answer to question one. And it almost seems to me that question two is just the reverse and overlay of question one, but he has a pretty broad answer to question two. Do you agree with his suggestions on both or just on question one?
With respect to question one, Your Honor, I think that the defect in plaintiff's answer to the question is that they are asking the court to enumerate the particular forms of communication that would be covered, whereas the Sixth Circuit's question simply asks about personally directed devices such as instant messaging, person-to-person emails, and private chat rooms. And so an illustrative answer is exactly what we're asking for, not the specific answer that they're recommending. And with respect to the second question on generally accessible websites and public chat rooms being excluded by the statute, we believe that the correct reading of the statute is exactly what the Sixth Circuit asked, and those are not covered.
So you agree with the first part of his answer, but you would limit it to
you would exclude from the exemption the private chat rooms.
If a speaker has sufficient control over a private chat room and knowledge, then a private chat room could be covered by the statute. And this court does have the avoidance canon that instructs that the statute could be construed in a way, should be construed in a way that would save its constitutionality. Therefore, we submit that the court should answer yes to the Sixth Circuit's questions.
Thank you, Mr. Meiser. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.